Oh, LA Podcast. Hayes Davenport here.
Scott Frazier.
Frazier here.
Live from Jay's Bar.
No, we didn't do that. So, okay. We did make a bet like two episodes ago where I said that Robert Arcos
was going to be the next police chief.
Said Michael Moore.
I said Michael Moore.
Based on no evidence, what you even said at the time.
It was completely uninformed, except one of the three candidates was a white man.
Yeah.
That, so I just went with my gut.
So here, what I think what I think happened there is, I guess Robert Arcos, his daughter was involved in a DUI, or a couple DUIs.
DUI manslaughter, I believe.
Yes. And he, I guess, was perceived as maybe intervening on her behalf a little bit. I'm guessing that that was seen as just a little too sticky.
My understanding is that that was available. That was information that the police commission had when they made their choice.
No, I'm sure they did, but I'll bet that's, I'll bet it was just gray enough of an area that it got him to the final selection.
Arcos is where he wrote a letter, I think an open letter, essentially saying how that had impacted his family and that they had gone and used that to go out and talk to, I think, high school students about the risks of drinking and driving and things like that.
Yeah. So. And what that open letter get him? Bupkis.
Right. But it's interesting, though. I kind of wonder. So we talked about Black Lives Matter, who is constantly at police commission meetings and was vocally unhappy with the police department in general and Chief Beck specifically. And they came out and said that that Michael Moore was the worst candidate available for the job once Garcetti had picked him.
Yeah.
I do kind of wonder, Garcetti said for his part that he wasn't interested in picking somebody in order to be the first of a particular ethnicity or gender, for that matter.
That's what you say before you pick someone the first of a particular ethnicity.
Yeah, right.
Right?
Right, yeah.
Not before you don't do
that. Before you don't do it. Just drawing
attention. You don't go back and then, see, I told you I didn't care.
It's a hard, I feel like that's a hard position to be in, because I feel like either way you go on that decision, there's either going to be somebody saying, just because you chose somebody who is a Latino, that's not actually changing the department, which is true.
Yeah.
Or if you don't pick somebody who is a particular ethnicity, you have now Gil Cedillo and a number of Latino legislators who are unhappy. Cedillo said in the paper, this is pretty, I thought, combative for just for something to be said in an open forum about the next police chief. He said that the city council still reserves the right to determine what qualifications are actually important for the next chief. And like, we'll see what happens, basically. So in any case, we kind of talked about the candidates and the fact that they were all representing continuity for the LAPD. That's the case here. Michael Moore is a guy who is respected for his particular reliance on statistics.
Knowledge of the stats. He's a freaking John Nash with the stats. It comes up in every single time they write about a master of stats.
Some game theory in LA policing. We'll see what happens there. But the flip side to Garcetti being in a hard position to make this choice is that if you actually want the police force to change, somebody actually has to be responsible for making those changes, whoever that ends up being.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
We're in the election hangover from the blowout primaries on Tuesday.
Yeah, I think
still reeling.
Nobody has talked about anything else. Yeah.
My favorite thing about the election aftermath, like the day after the election, is all the turnout scolds.
Yeah.
Basically, I love just picking up the newspaper the next day and just opening it and being blessed with like 10 articles just whining about turnout.
There was a great finger wagging article that was like, hey, Democrats, if you want to take back the House in November, why don't you try voting?
Try voting, oh, by the man. LA Times editorial board. Steve Lopez, who I like, went out with like a day of thing where he basically did a jaywalking segment where he went around and talked to, I think something like 8 people and asked them who they were going to vote for governor. And they were like, I don't know. And he basically like turned to camera and was like, he doesn't know. But they like everyone comes in so hot with their turnout takes. They never wait until all the numbers are in. God forbid wait until every ballot has been counted, so they can go with the lowest possible. They'll be like only 13% turnout, and it's like, yeah, that's all that's been counted right now. The number is definitely going to go up.
Right,
just wait.
In a state that's notorious for being very slow to count all of its ballots, we're going to go the day after and just be like, can you believe that only 8% of people turned out to vote? It's pretty wild.
Yeah, and what nobody talked about is that turnout was up this year from the last equivalent election, which was in June of 2014. Turnout for that was
about
17% at the very end of the day,
certified
in LA County.
In LA County,
and now in LA County, it's like 20%+, and it's going to go up.
We're over 20%, and it's still not certified. So, I think.
Okay, that's something. That's an improvement. But there's, you know, a gubernatorial election that is not seen as, was not like a super hot race.
Right.
You know, no, it wasn't that competitive. We didn't have in LA County the congressional races that everyone was like really excited about. The closest one was a Steve Knight's district that Katie Hill got into the runoff for, but that's only a tiny fraction of LA County.
Yeah, you have so higher turnout in places like San Francisco, I think, had really good turnout this election, but they also had an incredibly hotly contested,
an insane mayoral race,
as well as a number of ballot propositions that drove turnout in LA. Nothing really like that. I think this is probably an encouraging sign for people that actually
still
care
went
about
up,
turnout.
But that doesn't sell, apparently. Doesn't sell to say, like, good job doing better than last time. You have to say, shame on you.
Come on, Steve Lopez. Where's our pat on the back, I think? We turned those people out.
Yeah.
4%.
Thank you. What happened at this election is a good kind of, like, greatest hits. Or it's like a reunion episode for us.
Yeah.
Just, like, all the great characters that we've talked about in the past showing up. Christina Garcia won her primary.
Right.
Seems like she barely snuck in because she got like 29% of the vote and the next guy got 27%.
But that's a little bit
deceptive.
Yeah, it's a little bit deceptive because the second place candidate in that election was a Republican. There were a lot of Democratic challengers to Christina Garcia who were...
Yeah, a lot of people saw blood in the water and tried to get in there.
So they split the vote.
They split the vote. And now she's going to get all those Democratic votes and just smoke
she's
everybody.
She's going to clean up.
Tony Mendoza... was the wrongest prediction we've ever made on this show. We said that so this is a guy that was accused of being a creep, resigned from his position in the assembly.
Right, in the Senate.
Senate. And then as he was resigning, basically announced that he was going to run again for his own seat because he felt that he'd been like unfairly treated.
Sort of thumbing his nose at the establishment, as it were.
And that's very, people think that's cool when people thumb their nose at the establishment. So we definitely thought that he was going to make it in the primary. He didn't get very close.
Right. Turns out that the eat my shorts vote didn't turn out.
I guess people like, you know, in retrospect, patronizing on our part, especially my part, to think that people would just see his name and recognize it and vote for him again. But no, people knew that he had been accused of doing all this gross stuff.
Right.
And they did not want him to represent them anymore.
He got under 10% in the actual general election vote. I think he did a little bit better on the special election, just to finish his term, essentially, and then performed extraordinarily badly.
Really, really bad. But he didn't make the primary in the special election either. Yeah, just got completely wiped out. But some people, you know, Tony Cardenas has these allegations against him that are bad, but he still took a huge vote in his congressional district.
Yep.
It was a pretty wide variance in terms of how people reacted to different scandals that are out there, but there's also, you know, there's different degrees of culpability so far for some of the people that have been accused of these things. So I guess that makes sense.
Now, last week we talked about Josh Newman, another state legislator.
We didn't talk about him too much because I cut some of that stuff for time.
Oh, well, I mean, but the important thing there was really that we had an effort led by essentially Republicans, right-wing radio personalities, Carl DeMaio, John and Ken here in LA. Carl DeMaio is from San Diego. That was entirely founded upon the position that SB1, the gas tax increase, is bad, and that anybody who voted for it should be fair game. So they initiated a recall against Josh Newman.
Because he was like one of the deciding votes on it. He's in kind of a purple
Anybody district. Who voted for it was a deciding district.
Yeah.
It really got by.
Barely snuck through.
Barely. So Carl DeMaio said it was gazelle theory. They went for the person who won by the least amount of votes.
Yep.
So it was a contested district south southeast San Gabriel Valley, Diamond Bar, very suburban parts of the county. And they won. The recall was successful.
Successful recall.
So Josh Newman is out of the legislature, which...
with the supermajority for the Democrats.
Potentially means that the Democrats' supermajority is gone.
Yeah.
And I don't know... I don't think that the primary to replace him has been... Or the vote to replace him was conclusive. I think that will go to a runoff.
But didn't a Republican lead that?
Yes.
Vote? Yeah.
And it is entirely possible, I think, at this point that the Democratic candidate gets shut out. There's not that many votes separating the Democrat and the Republican.
Yep.
The second Republican, that is. So
that was notable. Everyone who's sweating the gas tax revolt got to be sweating a little harder now.
Yep. And that will make it much harder if the Democrats lose their supermajority. That is necessary to raise new taxes that could fund any number of social services. So that changes kind of the complexion of the remainder of the legislative year going forward.
We want to talk about a statewide election with a local boy involved. former mayor Antonio Villaraigosa was kind of seen as a potential guy to at least, if not challenge Gavin Newsom for the number one slot, to sneak into the top two.
Yep. At first it was they were perceived as the clear 1-2.
Yeah.
In some order. And mm-hmm. then as
he was probably leading or very close to leading a couple of polls for a little while.
Yeah, I would think so. That was really seen as he was going to shake up the electorate and change things that we have taken for granted about Californian politics, North versus South.
Yeah.
The impact of Latinos.
Yeah.
That did not happen.
Story did not play out the way people thought it would. He got absolutely waxed in the full election. I guess he did end up ahead of Travis Allen. So it seems like he finished third.
Right.
But he ended up with only 13% of the vote total, about half the votes of John Cox, the Republican who ran number two, who's from Chicago and showed up in California like 2 weeks ago.
Right.
Is a junk candidate. I mean, there's really no excuse for Villaraigosa to be running that far behind these guys. And it's not like, you know, Newsom is like a decent candidate, but he has some baggage. I think Villaraigosa does too, which is why he felt like this was a good election for him to run in. The sleaze factor would zero out between the two of them.
There's a lot of hair grease in this election.
Yes.
Not even just among the two of them. It's interesting. I think, from my perspective, it seems like he failed to really create meaningful separation between himself and Gavin Newsom in terms of what their policy preferences were.
Yeah.
One area, though, where potentially there was some divide was the divide that we talk about a lot on this show, which is between public schools and charter schools.
Yes. This is the debate that is increasingly shaping every aspect of California politics. There is just a staggering amount of money in it.
Yeah, it's driving funding, I would say, to a larger degree than I ever would have thought possible.
Yeah, and it was a huge part of Villaraigosa's like campaign war chest, even with like only a few days to go in the election where it looked like Villaraigosa was like not in great shape. A consortium of charter backers, the names you hear over and over again are Eli Broad, Mike Bloomberg, and Reed Hastings is the big one, the guy that runs Netflix. They in total put about 20 million plus behind Villaraigosa because of their longstanding interest in getting, like, in implementing more charter schools across California, but especially in LA for a lot of these guys.
And it's interesting. I mean, so Villaraigosa never really said that he was, he never made charter policy part of his platform, did he? Not that I'm aware of.
I don't think so. I mean, you were telling me before the show that Villaraigosa tried to take over essentially the LAUSD when he was mayor.
Yes. So LA has a relatively weak mayor compared to other large cities in America. Chicago, New York, those larger Eastern cities have mayors that actually control what goes on in the school districts. That's not the case.
Rahm Emanuel in Chicago is like demolishing schools left and right.
Yeah, and it's creating huge amounts of problems there. Villaraigosa, when he was mayor here, really fought to, he actually tried to go around essentially the school district to the state legislature. Get his friends there, because he previously had been in the legislature, to actually give him more authority over the school district and to kind of cut back on the perceived influence of the teachers union in local school district matters.
Yeah.
And that was ultimately unsuccessful. I think it was vetoed by Schwarzenegger. But so... now, I guess you have charter advocates who are seeing him, or were seeing him, as a potential person that would be willing to, again, stand up to the teachers' union in a way that might be favorable to their politics.
At least better than Gavin Newsom, who has taken sides on this as a teachers' union guy.
Newsom has been enthusiastically pro-union, pro-teachers' union. That has been... so we said we're not really sure whether Villaraigosa was pro-charter, but Newsom has been unequivocally pro-union. That's been a cornerstone of his campaign.
Yeah.
I imagine will continue to be as he faces off against John Cox. So that money, if that really is, you know, just purely oppositional to Newsom, again, that's $20 million is an enormous vote just because you're afraid of Gavin Newsom.
Right. And that money has flown into every level of educational politics in California. Basically, we have essentially a two-party system now in the education sector.
Yeah.
Where,
imagine you, that.
I mean, there was a race in LA for LAUSD 2 years ago between Steve Zimmer, who was president of the LA school board, and Nick Melvoin, who is a guy that I know a little bit. Who was like kind of running as an outsider from a pro-charter perspective.
Right.
I think Melvoin had over $5 million donated to his campaign from these same people, Broad and Bloomberg and Reed Hastings. And the teachers union responded with a huge amount of money from them as well. I think it was like $3.5 million for Zimmer. So it's like just like $8 to $10 million being spent on a school board race.
Yeah.
By far the most expensive school board race in American history.
And frankly, that just seems a little bit absurd. Like if we actually think about who stands to gain and what they stand to gain, I don't know. Does it actually match up with the amounts
so
of money?
So that's a question.
Spent?
I mean, it feels like, you know, the Koch brothers obviously have a huge financial interest in deregulation and lower corporate taxes and all these things. You get it. You
right.
see how the investment pays off. In this case, for a lot of them, it does seem like it's totally ideological. Either you hear people like you read interviews with Reed Hastings talking about it, and he talks about disrupting the system. He talks about how the education system is a monopoly and it needs competition. You know, it's a very like capitalist corporate ideology.
Right.
You know, the public education is a monopoly only to the same degree that like the fire department is.
Or any social service.
Any social service, yes. And it hasn't performed the LAUSD especially has not performed well on its own.
Right.
But these campaigns, I don't know. I just find it kind of ironic that this is a sector that is suffering financially. LAUSD especially owes has a huge budget shortfall. Mm-hmm. And there is clearly so much money around to be spent on behalf of education,
yeah.
but it's all going towards campaigns.
It's a lot of money going into lobbying. And I imagine that we see, if not an equal, probably a comparable amount being spent on the union side.
Yeah, so, I think in every case, it's like the union just comes in a little bit behind of the charter spending, but it's an arms race is what it's become.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. So it's a huge amount of money being burned in lobbying efforts, like you said, as a lot of our schools face an uncertain fiscal future due to declining enrollment and other conditions.
There was a story that this kind of manifested itself in a weird way this past week. The Inspector General of LAUSD, sort of the independent investigator who investigates fraud and waste and abuse and all these things, like he was fired essentially by the school board.
Yeah, they essentially failed to renew his contract. It was, I think it was a deadlocked vote. And it was 3-3 to whether or not to renew the contract. So the contract was not
because renewed. Ref Rodriguez abstained.
And this is another interesting, thing where, so the Office of the Inspector General is kind of peculiar to the LA Unified School District. It's not common for a local school district to have one, but LA Unified is enormous, second largest school district in the country after New York's. And as we said earlier, is not under the purview of really anybody besides the school board. So in order to have more independent oversight of what happens in the school system, they have this independent inspector general that there's been a lot of contention over how it operates. I think the specific concerns over this inspector general were about the workplace environment that he was, at least that was what was discussed in public, how he treated his staff or how staff were treating each other.
Yeah, apparently some allegations had come out against the guy's name was Ken Bramlett, the inspector general. And some allegations had come out, not about him, but some people that worked under him, maybe like deputy inspector generals and things like that, who also resigned a couple months ago, I believe, in March. And maybe the review came out and it was perceived by some that Ken Bramlett had not handled the situation effectively, so he was fired.
Yep.
But Ken Bramlett was seen as a guy that went pretty hard on charter schools.
And as a result,
the vote was evenly split, where the three people that voted to not renew his contract were the pro-charter wing of the board.
And that's fascinating. It's really
fascinating. You would think that these things wouldn't always have to come down to like your political position on this, but it seems like that's what, like we talked about how LAUSD always used to vote unanimously.
Yeah. There was a lot less sort of internal competition about what to do with the district.
The last like five superintendents were chosen unanimously. This time it was split 2-5, and that was after a 4-3 split. Somebody came over. So there's like this polarization that's happening now that is crazy. You would think that an investigation over how like an internal like HR issue was handled would not break down along pro-charter, pro-union lines.
So it's interesting. We discussed briefly one of the previous times that we talked about the school board that that there was some speculation about whether or not the vote on a new superintendent was happening when it happened for fear that Ref Rodriguez was going to get kicked off the board or that he was going to be in
prison. That was months ago.
Still nothing.
You're just sitting on the board abstaining from basically every consequential
vote. But part of the interesting thing here is that Ref Rodriguez, the reason he had a conflict of interest and couldn't vote is because he was under investigation by the Inspector General's office.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying necessarily that that is that this vote is taking place, or they're changing out the inspector general because they stand to potentially lose a member of their voting bloc.
It does seem like kind of a conflict of interest.
Yeah, it kind of seems interesting that it's happening at this specific point in time. It does potentially allow them to help maintain their majority. I don't even know if Ref Rodriguez can vote on the new contract for whoever they choose going forward. But definitely while he remains in there, we have the balance of power that we have that favors the charter wing.
And at the same time, the allegations against Ken Bramlett, it seems like the thing that got his subordinate fired, plausible allegations of discrimination, harassment, all this stuff that could get someone let go. But again, it broke down along these political lines that have nothing to do, seemingly, with the actual investigation, just like which side you're on. I wanted to talk about something that I read on Scott's Twitter feed, which is where I get most of my news. Scott,
as long as you only want news about trains.
Scott had some strong opinions on some trains. So apparently Metro came out with its with a few options for what they're going to do on the Sepulveda Pass, none of which is a Hyperloop.
Yeah, we're in on Elon's turf now. So we are returning to our old stomping grounds, the 405 adjacent corridor that is known to LA drivers all over. So we've got everything from the 405 in around the Van Nuys, Sherman Oaks area down to LAX. This is a crucial part of LA's transportation build out and the centerpiece of a couple of taxes that we've passed here. So the county has, or rather Metro has, $9.5 billion that locals have offered them in order to build essentially a rail line of some description.
Yeah. Here. So that's more respectful than the way you phrased it in your tweets, which was at Scott at S A Frazee, F R A Z I E. What's the A stand for?
Stop this again. Alexander.
Metro is considering four things for the Sepulveda Corridor, a project they have been gifted truly incredible amounts of money for. So I'm like, oh, okay, I'm buckled up for this.
It is incredible.
He's about to shred these four. Number one, a new heavy rail line that would connect the Orange Line to the Expo Line with a forced transfer to Van Nuys and a maximum of .. like 5 or 6 stops.
So what I was actually counting where the .. were.
Okay. Okay, because what I took for that was that you wanted more stops.
Well, I mean, so basically there's a heavy rail proposal that they're going to build a subway that would go north to Van Nuys Boulevard. Mm-hmm. But there's a separate project on Van Nuys Boulevard. And they've said that it's not going to be heavy rail. So if they do it this way, Metro is kind of arbitrarily saying they're not going to be, it's not going to be one line. They're going to be incompatible. So if I were coming down Van Nuys Boulevard,
you have to switch.
You would have to get off the light rail and then transfer to a subway to go in the same direction, which is not good from a planning perspective. There's
cheaper.
A limit.
Why?
The light rail would be cheaper because they're going to build it primarily at grade. Yeah.
Okay. But you're okay with that number of stop. What does forced transfer to Van Nuys mean?
That's what we were discussing. So
forced transfer to get on the line. Got it. But you're okay with that number of stops.
There's a limit to how many stops you can really do here. So there, this first segment, they're talking about connecting from the Orange Line. That's the east-west line in the valley, the bus line.
Yeah. The Sepulveda stop on that, right?
Yeah. Through Van Nuys.
Yep. Okay.
South through UCLA, connecting to the Purple Line, and then ultimately connecting to the Expo Line. So there's a limited number of stops that you can actually do there. But if you're talking about operating it as not an extension of a line on Van Nuys, then it's very short. So you're running trains back and forth a lot, making people transfer when it's not necessarily convenient for them to do so. For the time being, that's possibly something that you just have to live with. But if it's never going to change, then it's maybe not the best way to design the system.
Okay. Option two, light rail. This is the continuation of the blistering thread. Option two, light rail, a line that would extend a Van Nuys light rail, the line you were talking about that's right. already planned for Van Nuys Boulevard, 10 miles further south yep. across the pass, I assume through a tunnel.
Yep, to the expo line.
Although Metro says up front they would give Van Nuys, Pacoima, and Panorama City terrible service forever.
Forever.
What does that mean? How do they say that?
So basically in the presentation that they gave, this was from a public meeting they did last week. They're doing a series of them.
Okay.
They say that they would turn back every other train at the Orange Line. So so basically you would have one light rail line going from the city of San Fernando down through Panorama City, Van Nuys, some of the densest neighborhoods in the city of LA. Mm-hmm. That are also filled with low-income transit riders. Van Nuys is a very busy corridor. You would be able to take that same train into the LA Basin over to Westwood. That would be enormously groundbreaking and life-changing yeah. for a lot of transit riders currently.
A lot of people live up there and work
In the base, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, in the basement.
That would be very convenient if it actually extended into these residential areas where people live, where a lot of people live. It would be more useful than just having a park and ride train line. But what Metro is saying is that they're going to give those residential neighborhoods, mm-hmm. Pacoima, Panorama City, places that have been that have suffered through kind of like environmental justice issues for a number of decades, and also are less likely, the residents that are less likely to own cars, mm-hmm. They would give them half of the service that they would give the train line going south from.
Meaning running trains less frequently.
Less frequently, yeah. So if the train runs every 6 minutes across the pass, that's what they do on their trains currently. That's
okay.
the best frequency that we have available.
Yeah.
Compared to, I would say, rush hour average elsewhere, you can get trains every 2 minutes or whatever. Yeah. So if they do run it every 6 minutes across the Sepulveda Pass, then that means that at rush hour, people would be waiting 12 minutes for a train in Van Nuys or Pacoima. If they're doing it every 4 minutes, then you're waiting every 8 minutes for a train. And it's just not good service. Mm-hmm. It's by any stretch of the imagination. And I think
for the people that should be using it.
Yeah.
Relying
for
on
the people
it,
that will be relying
can connect
on
it actually to like to their homes rather than to a parking lot where they get in their car and drive to their
right.
homes.
And yeah. I find it objectionable that they said that this early on in the process.
Next tweet, not hard to imagine how that will go over in the Northeast Valley. You imagine
Council
that will go over poorly.
Councilmember Nuri Martinez, who represents the area, has been very loud about issues of transit equity, which, I mean, you need to be in order to actually get...
wanting the train lines up there.
Wanting better transit service in general.
Interesting, because she said that she, specifically, that she wouldn't ride the red line and she wouldn't bring her daughter on it.
Yes. She actually did say that she was afraid by the of the thought of riding on the trains, which, if you're an everyday transit rider... Look, I get it. I've seen a lot of sexual harassment, and it makes some sense to me. I was a little bit peeved to see a council member saying that in a public forum,
yeah.
like that or in that context.
But we're both men, and also very muscular men, very strong.
Yeah.
So no one is going to mess with either of us. So we can't really speak to that necessarily. Although I will, you know, it is scary sometimes. There are guys that get on to do dance
right.
moves, and it's often just like popping their shoulders in and out of its socket and doing stuff. It does seem, it is very intimidating and scary, but not for those reasons. But
right.
I do believe that stuff is going on.
It is going on. And, But not even just train lines. Like Nuri Martinez has been focused on getting better bus service and things
okay.
like that in her district. And as one of the two members of the city council that is a woman, she's actually focused a lot on how transportation choices affect women who make up a larger percentage of the public transit trips that are actually taken. So
yep.
I imagine this will not go over well with uh-huh. the elected officials that are in this district.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Okay. 5 minutes to running out of SD card time.
Okay.
Option three, an underground monorail. IDK, Scott says, whatever. And then it looks like an emoji of somebody throwing something in the trash.
Which is my favorite emoji.
You hate the underground monorail.
Why
idea.
Would you do an underground monorail? The whole
I don't
point
know.
Of
I mean,
the,
like, what's one fewer track?
The whole point
Save
of
money a, on track.
The whole point of doing a monorail is that it's very cheap and you just build it above ground. It can take a larger, a steeper grade than normal trains, so it can go up the hills in the past or whatever. This got added essentially as an option when BYD, who is the manufacturer from China of all of Metro's soon to be all electric bus fleet, okay, basically flew people from LA out to China to see their monorail that they build. So now it's an option on the table. I don't know. I don't think that this has a realistic chance of being chosen. The reason why they're doing it underground south of the pass is because that would obviously never fly in Bel Air to have a monorail going by any of these people's homes. I cannot imagine for one second that this will actually get built. That's why I don't know.
Let me see if people came through and your replies with a Simpsons GIF. Yes, they did.
It's actually just like automatic if you
can't
use the word
mention
monorail.
It. Yeah, it's so basic. option four, another all caps three-way junction. What on earth is happening over there, Scott says.
I had no idea my Twitter feed was going to be put so on blast.
I do need an explanation of it sometimes. So a three-way junction is bad, inefficient. Three-way junction, correct?
Yeah, that would be making the line through the Sepulveda Pass an extension of the Purple Line, essentially.
Whoa.
So you would have a lot. You would have three lines. You would have a line going from the Expo Santa Monica Bundy station to downtown LA. Then you would have another one going from that same station up to the Orange Line in the Valley. And then okay. You would have a line going from the Orange Line in the Valley to downtown
all
Los
the way
Angeles.
To downtown.
Metro has been doing this all over the place. They're currently building a three-way junction on the Crenshaw line.
Okay.
Where they're going to have they're splitting the Green Line, basically having it go to the South Bay and also up to LAX. And then they're having the Crenshaw Line go down the current Green Line to Redondo Beach. They're also planning to do the same thing for the Gold Line extension that would allow trains to go either to South El Monte or to Whittier, as well as having one line that goes from South El Monte to Whittier in a giant C shape.
Okay.
It's inefficient. It reduces the amount of frequency that you can offer. Metro obviously doesn't offer very good frequency to start with, but it really underestimates the importance of frequent service at the expense of the rider, basically. Mm-hmm. So
your preferred solution here is option one, a heavy rail line that extends all the way up Van Nuys Boulevard without the transfer to light rail along Van Nuys.
Yeah, basically. I think that would be the best option for the network. If they don't have the money to do it now, then they should essentially make sure that they build bus rapid transit on Van Nuys currently and then extend the heavy rail option further. I think if they build light rail now, the pressure is going to build to replace it with heavy rail anyway, so might as well just do it the right way the first time.
Follow Scott at SA Frazee for more train verdicts. 40 seconds left. It's gonna end up being too much time.
I feel like I was the guest today.
We got a couple cancellations, so yeah. thank you for listening to LA Podcast. We'll be back next week. Forever.